Welcome to the Rock Music Alliance interview sessions. I'm your host, Cole Coleman, along with Claudio Pesavento from Mahogany Rush and the Chris Squire Band. On our show today, you know his mixing and production from so many artists he's worked with, including Van Halen, Aerosmith, Kiss, INXS, Buck Cherry, Hailstorm, Daughtry, and many, many, many more, including recently Edge of Paradise and Crossbones Skelly. That's Tommy Henriksen's band, who's from Alice Cooper and the Hollywood Vampires. Welcome to our show, producer Mike Plotnikoff.
Hey, how you guys all doing out there?
We're doing fine over here, Mike. It's great to have you on our show. Thanks for coming on. Mike, what is your current and most interesting project that's going on?
Woohoo. Well, there's so many, you know, I hate to because they're all interesting. I don't like to leave anybody out, but I guess what I just finished is a new In Flames album, which we just finished. It's going to be, they're going to release an EP in between records or in between like full albums. So I just finished that, middle of November. And also a new project I'm working with called Silos. A kid named Ray Garrison is his band, and signed to Howard Benson's label, Judge and Jury. Howard Benson and Neil Sanderson from 3 Days Grace. So just did that record. We just pretty much finished it. I did vocals yesterday for that. We had some guest vocals on it. So I was working on that. And I think that's the last song to go on the record. It just needs to be mixed. And they've released a couple singles already. So that's it. And then probably going to do a new King record. I'm not sure. Probably start that in the new year. And that's what I have up and coming. And then speaking of Edge of Paradise, I'm in the studio on Monday with Margarita. She's doing, I don't think it's Edge of Paradise. I think she told me she's singing on somebody else's record. Not sure whose, but she wants me to produce the vocals for it. So that's kind of where I'm at right now.
You know? Right, right. She's been doing, I noticed, a fair amount of cover stuff. She's been reinterpreting and doing the Edge of Paradise versions of other people's stuff. I guess it's only natural that eventually people start inviting her to sing on their records, you know?
Yeah, she's been getting a lot. And I think, you know, she's very personable and very likable. So she's done a lot. I used her on the new OTEP record. She did all the background vocals on the new OTEP record I just finished, which I think it just came out not long ago, maybe the summertime. And then, yeah, she's been doing guest vocals on other projects. You know, people want a female or a female artist or a guest spot, and they've been asking Margarita to do it.
Yeah, I got to mention for anybody watching, go check out Edge of Paradise. This is one of the more unique voices, I think, in rock in general, but certainly in current rock. You know, I think she's terrific, and it's so, and very unusual. She's really singing in the stratosphere a lot of the time, you know?
She's amazing, and she's super musical, comes up really interesting parts, very musical. She's super talented. Yeah, I really like working with her. I've done three full records with Edge of Paradise. And then I did an EP with them where I first met them. And that's how we built the relationship and started working. But yeah, I really like them. I think they're super interesting and very.
She's from another dimension.
Yeah, she's from another dimension. Exactly. And just all around good people and really fun to work with and make records with and very creative. It's really fun being in the studio with them. We just have a great time, and we're just open to everything, you know, and the creativity with them, because they're always willing to experiment and try things. So it's really fun. You're not put in the box, so to speak, you know, where it has to be in a certain line. She's always willing to try things and, you know, step outside the box, I guess you could say.
Right. And she's quite an accomplished piano player as well.
Oh, yeah. Super classical trained, and just a great ear for music and really good writing. And you know, she's a great producer herself. She comes in with the tracks, a lot of them produced that she does. It's, you know, just writing string parts and everything. A lot of fun working with her.
Terrific, terrific. Speaking of Edge of Paradise, I wanted to mention, we know that you've been working with them this past year on their album Hologram. I love your work with Edge of Paradise. You can hear like layers upon layers of stuff going on in their music. I call it three-dimensional production. You know, songs like Soldiers of Danger and Basilisk. You know, is that a particular production style that you like working in as well? Or you mentioned that you're able to do that stuff with Edge of Paradise? You know, other people, do they want things, you know, more simply done?
Yeah. You know, it's a, like I tailor for each project, you know, it's like, I try to get the best out of the project I'm working on, because yeah, like when I just finished an In Flames record, they don't want all that stuff. It's just really guitars, drums, get the performance, get the sounds and tones. So it's a little more simpler, you know, even like you mentioned Crossbone Scully for that record. We, you know, when Tommy talked to me, cause I did the Hollywood Vampires record, and you know, we came in the studio and go, let's make an AC/DC Back in Black. He liked the Buck Cherry record I did, you know? And after working on the Vampires with him, Tommy and I just got along. So he got off tour and he goes, let's go in and make a, you know, try this record, you know, we'll make it sound like Back in Black, like AC/DC throwback. So that's what we kind of went in and did. And that's why the record turned out it did. With Edge of Paradise, you know, Margarita loves all the strings and she likes that kind of layering. So that's what we work on. So I try to tailor to each project. I'm never, you know, I never try to just go, this is the way it has to be. It's like, what's the artist? Like, I think of myself as the painter. If somebody brings their car into paint, even though I could do a great flame job, if they don't want a flame job, I'm not going to give them a flame job. If they just want a flat black, I'll do the best flat black. But if they want a flame job, then I'll give them a flame job.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Crossbone Scully is sounding great to me as well. I'm enjoying the song I'm Unbreakable.
Yeah.
And and I got to say, you nail it right on the head. It's like it's like a blend to me. It's like a blend between AC/DC and Def Leppard, you know, roll into one.
Well, that's exactly like it is. Do you know the full story behind that record?
Oh, no. Tell us.
Okay. So Tommy and I came in and we started tracking the record, and we did the first 10 songs, and it was during COVID. Over COVID, we were working, and he would, when he was on tour with Alice, he would come, you know, book time here in LA. We'd come and do some tracking. And after we did, I think the first 10 songs, his friend goes, man, you guys like really nailed this AC/DC vibe. It's like, it's right on. He goes, my friend is Mutt Lang. He goes, I'm going to play for Mutt. And Tommy's going, oh yeah, right. Blah, blah, blah. So his friend sent it to Mutt, and Mutt called Tommy literally a day later and goes like, you guys nailed this. He goes, I want to work on it.
Oh, and wow.
Tommy goes, well, I can't afford to pay you. It's like, you know, you're Mutt Lang. And he goes, no, he goes like, I'm retired. He goes, I just want to work on it because it's such a good record.
Wow.
So send me the tracks. And that's why it sounds like that. Then Mutt went and put, you know, did his production on it, did all the background vocals and all the stuff. So that's why it sounds like it does too. That's why it went to that next level.
Wow.
Yeah, it sounds great. You've checked it out, Claudio? You've been checking that out?
Yeah. All this stuff.
the whole record is amazing. And so we ended up recording 50 songs. There's four records, and every song we did is amazing. Every song is a smash hit on that record.
Wow.
And it was just, it was like so much fun working with it. And Tommy's such a great guy, and I love Tommy.
He's
an amazing guy. So we just get along, and we have the exact same taste in the studio. So it's so much fun, you know, it was so much fun making that record. Yeah. And I think it sounds incredible.
You mentioned 50 songs. You guys recorded 50 songs?
50 songs.
Wow.
And we did it over a two-year period.
During the pandemic.
We started a little before the pandemic, and then all through the pandemic and you know, into 2020, you know, what was that? We started, I think, in the fall of 2019. Yeah, just before the pandemic hit. And then we worked all through the pandemic, just different times. He'd come out here, and then we just kept doing it. And then, I played it for Alan Kovac, and then we had the record done, and like Tommy didn't really know what to do with it. So I said, well, you know what, I have a long relationship with Alan Kovac. I thought, let me play it for him. This would be like right up his alley, you know? So I sent it to Alan Kovac actually on a Saturday morning. I didn't even think he would call me. I just said, hey, Alan, check this band out. I didn't tell him anything about it. I just finished this project. Let me know what you think. It was literally, I went got in my car. It was only a couple hours, and he called me back. I said, like, dude, what is this stuff? This is amazing. Like, who is this? Is it like 20, you know, he didn't know who this band is. How did I not hear them? He goes, who are they? I go, well, it's Crossbones Scully. I go, but I got to tell you, Alan, it's not what you think. It's not like some 20-year-old kids. And he goes, well, who is it? Because this is big. And I go, well, it's Tommy Henriksen. It's from, you know, the guitar player from Alice in Chains. And actually, Mutt Lange worked on it. And then Alan basically signed it pretty much on the spot on my, you know, let's do a phone call meeting with Tommy on Monday when I get to the office. And so basically I hung up from Alan and called Tommy and said, yeah, you know, Alan loves this stuff. He wants to have a meeting, you know, a phone call meeting. So we all hopped on a call on Monday morning, and that was it, you know, basically pretty much signed him on the spot.
Well, I mean, it's like, to me, it'd be like a no brainer. I mean, you know, Tommy's already a star, you know, so yeah. he's world known. So it's a chance to sign up an already existing star with built in, you know, following. So awesome. Yeah. Score major.
Yeah. So it was just fun that, you know, because, and two, when we were making the record, when we first started out, we were like, you know, both Tommy and I are huge Mutt Lange fans. So we're going like, oh yeah. Like, so we're comparing AC/DC, and I always had Back in Black playing on loop. So I'd always be A-ing going back and forth between what we were tracking and AC/DC Back in Black, and going, yeah, we're pretty close. This is really good, you know? And
yeah. Well, and were you listening to Def Leppard as well? I mean,
we didn't listen to Def Leppard, but when it came back from Mutt really added the Def Leppard. It wasn't Mutt really put that Def Leppard. Yeah, the vocals, the vocal production, the harmonies, then the way the drums basically was more Def Leppard drums. It's a combination of Def Leppard meets AC/DC, but that's Mutt. And it was just like, wow, this is like amazing. Like when it came back, the stuff Mutt did, I'm just going like,
he lives in Switzerland.
Yeah. He lives in Switzerland.
Tommy's from Switzerland, so
yeah, he's living there now. And it was just, yeah, it was just so much fun. It was like almost a dream come true. You know, I did work with Mutt long time ago with Brian Adams. So back in the 90s, I worked on some stuff with Mutt. So I did have a relationship, and he totally remembered me from, you know, back then working, you know, so like probably like 96 was the last time I worked with him. And then then happened to hook up again on this Crossbones Scully record.
It's great. And it, just like you were talking about earlier, you know, about the people using, you know, tracks to bring the production to life. Tommy, if you're listening, you're going to have to get those vocals live, man.
Yeah.
All that, that's those layers and stacks of vocals.
Yeah, it's just amazing. It's just it was so fun. And then just listening to the finished product on it after it went through Mutt, it was just like, wow. It was like, it's a record that I'm super proud of. Like that you hear in your head that you always want to make, and it turns out sounding like that. That's one of them.
Oh, it's going to be fun. I'm just thinking, you know, picturing, you know, the music I'm hearing from Crossbones Scully, and given, you know, Tommy's personality, that's going to be a really fun band. And it's going to be a great live presentation, I'm sure. You know, you guys tracked, is it Tommy on guitar only in the studio, or did you get a chance?
Tommy Denander played some of the guitar as well. Like Tommy sent him the tracks and he added guitar tracks as well.
Who?
Tommy Denander?
Yeah.
So he played a lot of this stuff too, which he just did at his home. So yeah.
Yeah, because he's got a great young rising star in his band, uh-huh. You know, called Sam Bam Colton. I was just wondering if Sam, you know, got to do some recording.
I don't know.
He's on the video.
Yeah.
The music video.
Yeah. Have you heard of him yet? Have you heard of Sam yet?
No.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, let me mention him again. His name is Sam Colton. He's known on the scene a lot as Sam Bam. And he's the guitar player for several people right now. He's the guitar player for Dorothy.
Okay.
And he's the guitar player for, you know, Crossbones Scully and a local band in LA called Butterside. And he sometimes sits in with Jason Charles Miller at live gigs. You know, a buddy of his plays guitar. So he's one of the truly a rising star on guitar right now. He's a young guy. He's a young guy too. I think he's only like 26 around, something like that.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think he played on any of the tracks. I think Tommy probably got him after the fact when he's putting the band together, because he was
For the music video.
Yeah, for the music video and the band. And I know he got Tuesday on drums, which I've known Tuesday for a while, and then the other guitar player, Anna.
Yeah, but it's great. In a way, Tommy is following in the steps of Alice Cooper, where, you know, he's got his young hotshot star of tomorrow in his band, you know?
Yeah. And it looks good. It gives it a good image, right? Because you don't want just a bunch of old dudes playing, you know.
Yeah.
You know, get that kind of music. So it makes it fun. And like, I think he did a really good job of putting the band together.
Well, now with Snapchat, you look young anyway.
Exactly. Put some young, good looking girls in your band and it looks good. And Tuesday's a great drummer. And So it's like, I think the band looks really good. I think the videos look great. I think it's like a really good look. So,
yeah. Oh, it's going to be a great band. There's no doubt in my mind. That's going to be a fun band. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if Johnny Depp steps in here and there to jam on a tune.
Oh, I'm sure he will. I'm sure he will.
That'll be a lot of fun. Yeah. Well, you have worked with so many great guitar players, you know, including, you know, classic rock guitar players like AC/DC's Angus Young and Eddie Van Halen. So what can you tell us about recording their guitar sound and recording guitar in general?
Well, with, you know, working with Eddie and Angus Young and the more classic guitar players, they already have their tone. So they know what they want. And when they set up in the live room, whatever's coming out of their amp, that's, you need to create that through the speakers. So they don't want any variation to that sound. They've worked their whole life to come up with their tone and their sound. And I need to make sure I capture what's coming out of the speaker in the room, what they've been used to for years and years of playing. When I work with newer artists, it's more like, let's create our own guitar tone as we go. So they're both difficult in a way, because when you're trying to create something new or good, you know, nobody knows what are we even creating? What are we going for? So we're just kind of, you know, shooting in the dark, I guess, so to speak, but, you know, because we don't know what we're really looking for. It's a little bit of trial and error until we stumble upon something. Where Angus and Eddie come in and they got their tone, so I need to make sure that when they come in the control room and they're listening through the speakers, they're getting that same feel and that same vibe as when they're standing next to their guitar amp. And if there's any variation, they're going, well, why doesn't it sound like, where's the low end's different, or the mid range different, or the high, it's too bright. Or so, you know, same when I worked with Carlos Santana, he's very picky on what mic and what tone. If it's a little too bright, or he thinks it's a little too buzzsaw or too much fuzz on it, like he'll freak out, like what's going on. Where like a newer artist will go, oh, it's like a little bit, yeah, there's some fuzz on it, that's kind of cool, you know, and they'll go with that. They'll go, so then you go, okay, that's, everybody thinks that's a cool sound, let's go with that, you know, or that distortion. But for the classic guys, they know exactly what they want to hear to every frequency from the bottom all the way to the top. So if you're missing any low mids or got a little too much high mids or too much top, whatever it is, they're on you like, no, this is not right. So you have to make sure your mic placement is right, where the room is, what your, you know, preamp you're using, EQ, if any compression, whatever you're using on their guitar amp. They want it natural, organic, exactly like it's how they feel it in the room when they're playing. So
do you like to record guitars in a really dead room, or do you like a little bit of room sound?
It varies. For rhythm guitars, if it's just rhythm and heavy guitars, like more like Marshalls through a 4x12, I like it more tight and dead, so it's very more present. If I'm recording combo amps, I like a little bit more space.
How about
if I'm doing AC30s or like old Fenders or Gibson, you know, Gibson combo amps, or, you know, off the top of my head, you know, Watkins or whatever I use, you know. Yeah, I like the space, a little more room sound, just to give it a little bit of life. But rhythm guitars, heavy rhythms are fairly tight.
Any special mics that you prefer?
You know what? I'm very simple. It's pretty much a 57 and a 421, and that's all really I use. And you know, when I recorded Van Halen, Eddie was like just a 57. And nobody ever complains about my guitar sound. You know, people try different mics, but for me, 57 always works. I never get into trouble. It always passes. I never get people coming back, oh, the guitar sound's not working, blah, blah, blah. So if I just stay with my 57, I know it works. I know it works for me. And that's pretty much what I stay with. Every now and then I'll add a little 421, or, you know, if I'm doing a guitar solo, maybe just change the blend of the mics a little bit. If I'm using combo amps, I will use like a Royer or, you know, maybe a C24 or C12 on it, or U47, some vintage mics. But, you know, 57 just works for me, and I just stay with it. And it hasn't proved me wrong yet. So,
yeah, it's amazing to hear that, really, because, yeah, I just think of, I mean, a Shure 57, you know, just the old tried and true, right?
Yeah, it's tried and true. And like, it's like a running shoe. Like, if it works, why reinvent it? And it always captures the right sound. It just has the right mid range. It has enough bottom. I never have to EQ the mic. It's, you know, if I use like other mics, will pick up more stuff, but then you start getting like the low mids are a little too much. And then when you start having to mix, then you start having to EQ. And once you start having to EQ, your guitar sounds too much. Then it's like starts, you know, you're introducing phase into the sound. And so I just try to stay away from that, unless there's something that we're really trying to go for differently. But if I'm just really going for the basics, the 57 just always works. It just has the right amount of bottom, right amount of mid, the right amount of top. I don't have to add any EQ to it. So if the sound is not there with the mic, then it's the amp. Then I know, like, okay, I have to add a little bit more to the amp, rather than I go, well, I got to insert an EQ now. And I just don't want to do that with guitar sounds.
How about some of the more current or, you know, modern guitar sounds where there's like just so much, you know, beefy chunk in it? You know, does the 57 still capture that?
It doesn't, but I think a lot of that is added after the fact, you know, in the mix, and they're added with plugins.
Yeah.
So if I'm just recording, you know, the basic, what I'm doing with real guitars, is the 57 gets all that. If I want that more modern stuff with all that bottom, then I got to start adding plugins, and that comes more in the EQ and the mixing. Then a lot of that stuff is added.
Right. What's that, Claudio?
He has a Neve.
A Neve console.
Ah, yeah.
Right there.
Yeah, there you go.
Yep.
I was going to mention, and we're currently at the moment in time when amp modelers have become so good. You know, do you find yourself recording, you know, with amp modelers as much or even more than amps?
No. So everybody that comes to me.
He got so many amps in here.
Yeah. Everybody that comes to me really they don't want to use the modelers because everybody has it. So they still come to me because they want to use the real stuff. They want real drums. They want real bass guitar, real bass amps, real guitar amps. They want to stay away from that. Now, if we need to add to it in the mix, or they feel at the end of the project the guitars just aren't there, then I record a DI with everything I do. So then we could start reamping stuff later. But they, like In Flames, they want to use the real stuff. They go, listen, I can make a record at home if I want. I could just sit in my basement and use all the amp modelers, but they don't want to do that. And now they don't want to sound like everybody else. The thing is that the amps are always going to sound a little bit different every day you come in, depending on the power, the electricity, whatever. They just, you know, they move air differently. The modelers don't really move the air like an amp does. You don't capture those harmonics that you get from a real amp. And so the artists I'm working with still want that. Yes. Now they might want later on, like I said, in the mix stage where, hey, listen, we need to sound just a little bit more modern. So let's add something with the plugins on the DI and go from there. But like, yeah, so that's why I recorded DI with, no matter what, even if I do like a feedback guitar, I still record a DI with everything I do. There's always a DI recorded with every track.
Sounds like good advice. Good advice. Yeah. Of the amp modelers out there, do you have a preference that you would work with? You know, Kemper, Fractal, Neural?
I like the, so I use my STL. I have a plugin with Howard Benson. I don't know if you know, it's from STL Tones. So I use that one a lot, which we modeled after all our amps, and it's good. And then I like the Neural DSP. So those are really my go-tos on them, but I try to stay with, you know, my STL Tones one or the Neural DSP.
Yeah. I was curious about drums. You mentioned drums, and that was where I was going next was, you know, with drums, there's such great sounding sample libraries these days. You know, do you find yourself triggering sample libraries more than recording the real thing? But you mentioned a lot of people, you know, like recording. So, well, what do you think?
Well, I'm using samples with everything, but still, again, the stuff I'm doing, they really don't want that. They want to stay as organic as possible, like beefing up a little bit so there's a little bit of sample underneath, but they want all the real tones. And that's why people still come to me. They want the real drums, the real instrumentation. Yes, if we got to beef it up, let's add a little bit of a sample underneath the snare and a little bit under the kick. And that's really it, just to, you know, tighten it up a little bit, give a little more weight. But it's pretty much the real drums. I would say it would be maybe anywhere between a 60-40, 70-30 mix of, I'd say more 60-40 probably, real to sample ratio.
Well, it sounds great, no doubt about that. Like I said, I love your recordings, you know. What do you think, Claudio? Do you like using samples? Oh,
yeah,
or?
If you go in the back in the live room, he has so many amps, like any amps that you want to ever see in your life, they're there. And he has some in here too.
I'll show you around after the interview. I'll walk you around.
That'd be great.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. Attention guitar players, join the Thimble Slide Revolution and free your slide finger. The Thimble Slide is a mini guitar slide designed to be worn on the tip of your finger, about 3/4 of the way down your fingernail. When worn there, you can still bend your finger, and most importantly, it's allowing enough of your fingertip through so you can press the guitar strings. The Thimble Slide is larger at the back and smaller at the front, so it follows the contour of your finger. So when you're wearing the slide, it's not loose or rattling around on your fingertip. This also allows your other fingertips in nice and close for playing. The sizing gap allows you to make the slide a little bit larger or a little bit smaller for a nice custom fit. So while you're wearing a Thimble Slide, you can, of course, use it as a slide. But more importantly, it allows you to still fret the strings so you can play the guitar. You can play chords. You can play lines while wearing it. You can bend strings with your ring finger. You can drag your fingertip across the strings if you need to. You can do pull-offs, hammer-ons. So there you go. You can actually still really do all the things you need to do to keep playing guitars like that. With its patented shape, you can slide and fret while wearing the Thimble Slide. Visit thimbleslide.com. That's thimbleslide.com.
You know, Mike, when I was reading up on you, I didn't see a lot on the web about your early background. If you would, you know, take us back to your beginnings and tell us, you know, where were you born and raised?
So I was born and raised in a small town in British Columbia, Canada, called Grand Forks. It's basically a border town. I lived right on the Washington state border. So people, you know, in America listening to this, if you were to go to Spokane, Washington, and drive basically 2 hours north, you would hit the border and you would hit Grand Forks, BC. And that's where I grew up. Then after I finished high school, I moved to Vancouver I've been with my wife since I was 15. So we've been together since we were in the 10th grade. We packed up. I wanted to be a recording engineer, and we finished high school and we moved to Vancouver And then I started working at Little Mountain Sound, which was obviously with Bruce Fairburn and Bob Rock. So that's where I started. So I was, you know, started out as a runner at the studio, answering phones, but slowly worked my way up to be an assistant engineer, and then, you know, worked on with Bruce on Aerosmith, and then was his engineer, and then did three Cranberries records with him, and INXS and the Yes records and AC/DC. So that's where I started. And then Bruce passed away in 1999. We were in the middle of a Yes record.
Really?
Yeah. And I just started to mix the record. We just finished tracking. I was the first day of mixing, and, you know, I didn't even get through the first mix, and Bruce passed away. I ended up finishing the Yes record, and then things kind of slowed down, because for 10 years I was always relying on Bruce. You know, we'd do three records a year, pretty much from September to May or June, and then we'd take the summers off. So we'd spend, you know, doing Aerosmith record, and then go into a Van Halen record and a Kiss record. So I did all those records with Bruce. Then when he passed away, I really had nothing. It really slowed down. And then my friend Reese Fulber, who I mixed a Delirium record for him, and Reese is also a producer from Vancouver, and he was in Frontline Assembly, great programmer, had these Delirium records, and he produced, or I mixed this song called Silence for Delirium with Sarah McLachlan on it, and it turned out to be a huge hit all over the world.
Right, I remember that. I love that track. Yeah, I love that track.
So anyways, things weren't really started stagnating, you know, were stagnant after Bruce passed away, and David Foster was producing a Josh Groban record, and he called up Reese and said, hey, like, Josh loves that one song, Silence, that you did with him. I want you to do like two songs for Josh Groban that are in that vein on the record, even though it's 12 songs. So Reese goes, well, I need Mike to do it, you know, because Mike was really a big part of that and mixing. So I want to bring Mike down to LA with me and do these two songs with Josh. So I came down to LA, and this was in 2000, and we finished that. And then Reese, who had produced a couple of Fear Factory records after, was going to do the Fear Factory record Digimortal. And he goes, well, Mike, why don't you stay in LA with me and do Digimortal with me? So I ended up recording and mixing the Digimortal record for Fear Factory. And then I met his manager, Aaliyah Fallberg, who was with Network. And she loved the record. And she goes, you know what? I got to play it for this producer I manage named Howard Benson, because he really needs an engineer. He has these other engineers, but his records aren't, he's a great producer, but his records don't sound great because he's never had a really good engineer. So he introduced me to Howard, and I had a meeting with Howard, and we got along after the first meeting, you know. And he goes, yeah, maybe I'll try you out on a record. So nothing really happened. I went back to Vancouver, finished the Fear Factory record, and literally a month later, I got a call from Aaliyah and goes, you know, Howard's going to produce this record on Reveille, a record on Elektra Records, this band called Reveille, and he just wants you to come down and just record the drums, bass, and guitars on it, and he'll finish the rest. He'll do the vocals and blah, blah, blah. So anyways, I came down to LA for a couple weeks, tracked just the drums, basic rhythms and bass, and then went back to Vancouver, did some rough mixes for them, and went back to Vancouver. Nothing. Then I'm doing some small projects in Vancouver. And then Aaliyah called me back and goes, you know, they really like your rough mixes. You want to come back and mix the album? So I said, sure. So I ended up flying back to LA and mixed the record. And it turned out really good at the time. And then Howard asked me, he goes, well, I'm doing this other record on Atlantic Records named Brad Kane. So he goes, you want to stay and do it? So I said, sure. So I ended up staying, finishing the whole record with Howard. I think this was like the summer of, or the spring of 2001. And after I finished the record, he goes, well, I have good news. And he already knew I was in LA for quite a while. He goes, well, I got good news and bad news. And I go, well, what's the good news? He goes, well, I have another record coming up. And he goes, well, I go, what's the bad news? He goes, well, you won't be able to go home. Uh-huh. So I'm going like, oh. So I called my wife and I go, listen, I go, okay. I go, I don't think I'm coming home. I go, maybe we should think of moving to LA. And she goes, okay. And we ended up selling our house in Vancouver, and I moved to LA, and then Howard and I just went on this run for, and I'm still working with Howard, you know, it's like him and I now, Howard has his own label, and obviously he signed Edge of Paradise is partly on Judge and Jury Records, which is Howard's record. And yeah, so, and we're still going to get together. We did the In Flames record together. And so that's kind of where, yeah, it's, you know,
that's a great story, a great story of your life, you know? And yeah, I'm glad Howard found you.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's great. And we're still making records together, and yeah, still going and still love doing it. You know, it's still like, you know, I can't believe I get, this is what I get to do for a living, and I get to do this. And we worked with so many great artists, but yeah, so that's where I came from, you know, basically Grand Forks to Vancouver to LA.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. You mentioned, of course, I guess you would call him your mentor, probably your mentor, you know, Bruce Fairbairn.
Yeah. Fairbairn. Right?
And I wanted to mention to the anybody listening, you know, for our listeners, Bruce Fairbairn was a legendary Canadian producer whose credits include Bon Jovi's Slippery When Wet, Aerosmith's Permanent Vacation, Pump, and Get a Grip albums, Kiss, Psycho Service, and, you know, many, many more, including his final work, as Mike mentioned, on Yes's album, The Ladder.
Correct.
And he was working with Bob Rock, right?
Yeah, and I worked with Bob not very often, but very in the very beginning I did. Like the first record I worked on with Bob was the Greatest Hits record for Cher. And that's basically how I got in, because I was answering phones. I just started answering phones at Little Mountain. And it was pretty much the fall of, I guess, 1990. I was working at this other studio, yeah, 89 or 90. And nobody wanted to work over the Christmas holidays. It came up to Christmas, and I was just answering phones. And Bob was going to come in and do a Greatest Hits record, three songs for Cher on a Greatest Hits record. And I'm going, I'll work. And Bob's looking at me going like, no, you know, like, you're, who are you? You're just some kid answering phones. And then finally he couldn't get anybody. And he looked at me and goes, okay, you're, you know, you're doing it, but, you know, don't mess up. And Mike Fraser was the engineer.
Oh,
yeah. on the record. So I was the assistant, and I went in there, and because prior to that, even though I was answering phones, I would come in early to the studio and then I wouldn't leave at night when everybody left. I would take a boom box into the studio and mic it up and learn how all the gear worked, what every mic did, what it sounded like. So when I was ready to get my chance, I knew what everything did. So they were really impressed. And then we finished that record, and then Bruce was coming in to do a live record with AC/DC. It was basically, they recorded all their, it was Donington, AC/DC at Donington, the live
record. England.
Yeah, all over. I'd so yeah, so all those tapes came in, and then Mike Fraser and Bob Rock both told Bruce, yeah, use Mike on it. He was like really good on it. So that's why Bruce tried me out as the assistant. And then I basically was the assistant on that record. And then the end of Get a Grip is when I kind of, he had me engineer the last little bit of Get a Grip. And that was my first kind of record that I engineered part of the record, and obviously turned. And then basically I was his engineer for the next 10 years on all the Van Halen. And like I said, Cranberries, Yes, Kiss, INXS. I don't know what else, Scorpions, all these other records that I did with him for 10 years until he passed away. And then, but yeah, Bruce is amazing. And it was fun because we got to travel all over the world making records, like doing the Cranberries records in Ireland and INXS in Spain. And we did records everywhere. So it was a lot of, and he was amazing. Bruce is just so talented as a musician, and he just understood production and songs and writing a lot, like Howard Benson is too. Like I got to work with these great guys that really understand the songs, and you know, they don't get wrapped up in the weeds of production. It's like all about getting the best song.
Yeah. You know, we just have time for a couple more questions, but I did want to touch on one very interesting thing. Fascinatingly, I've heard that you have synesthesia, you know, the condition where you see colors while hearing music.
Who told you that?
Oh, just my little ways. You know, I find stuff out, you know, now is that true?
And that is.
And does it help you in your mixing?
Absolutely. Because, and you know what, I didn't really know I had it. It started out like long when I first started mixing, like I noticed that I could see things. Like I really knew where the cymbal should sit. I could just see it. So I always pictured like just a live band, like what you would think, very generic, you know. Oh, here's where the cymbal sits. Here's where the hi-hat sits and, you know, the guitars. And I could picture everything on stage so I could place it. Like it's very visual, more than listening. Like if I look at the speakers, so a lot of times, like I'll even mix backwards because I don't like looking at the speakers because I see everything. So as time started progressing, started noticing it more. And then I started going like, I don't know. I just started thinking about it. I didn't even know what it was called or a symptom. I'm just going like, it always works, you know? And then just in my head, you know, like, you know, you just talk to yourself and I would go like, what if I do this? And then I started going, and then later on, just like messing around, I thought, well, what if I saw like an apple tree? And then I would look out the window and picture an apple tree and go, well, what if I painted an apple tree? Like, let me just do like, what if it was red over here? Cause I see red, it looks red to me. I don't even know if it's true because so I would do these stupid things just in my head. And then when the people would listen to it, they would get a vision too. Like, oh man, when I listen to that song, like I picture myself like on a boat on like a storm coming. So I would begin, even though that's not at all what I envisioned, I'm going like I was envisioning an apple tree in my backyard.
Wow.
So I started doing and then just started like really working on it. I'm going, huh, that's interesting. So then when I would mix and then I would like some days, like I just don't see anything. And I would struggle on a mix and just like, I don't know, is the kick loud enough? What am I supposed to be doing? And the mixes were always, they would never pass and would be, you know, just, pulling teeth to try to get, you know, get this mix finished, you know, that the band would approve or management or the record label. But every time I would see stuff, I would go like, it was pretty much always perfect. I never really had any comments with the mix. So this started going, then I started going, well, let me picture like an alien spaceship. What if I mixed and, you know, there'd be blue lights here and I could picture the blue. And then it started going like, huh, like, yeah.
That's for Margarita.
Yeah, I could see a spaceship or whatever.
Yeah, I was just going to say Margarita Monet would love that, right?
Yeah, well, I've talked to her many times about it. So then it started getting, and then, you know, I started listening to more music and then I started, you know, like I'm a huge Pink Floyd fan. And I go, man, like I could really see the colors in Pink Floyd. Like these people have what I'm seeing because I see the pictures clearly. Like this is no accident that Pink Floyd is doing what they're doing or Massive Attack. Or if I listen to anything Spike Stent mixed, I would go, wow, like he must have this too, what I have, because this is not a mistake. Because I listen to other music and it's just, you know, it's good, but it doesn't have these images that certain people have in their production. And I'm going like, wow, like I don't know if I've never talked to them about it, but I'm going, when I listen to these records, they have this imaging. Same with Mutt. If I listen to AC/DC or any of the AC/DC, there's this imaging going on that cannot be by accident. So I really started really focusing on and honing in on it and would like practice. And then for, you know, it really started showing up probably about 15 years ago, maybe like 2005. So when I started in 1989, I just, you know, but then it really started clicking. Like I really started developing this where I could see the colors. Like I go like, oh, like, I listened to it and I'm able to see these. So I started trying to incorporate it, going like, is this just in my head that this is happening or is this really going on? So I kept doing it and doing it and got to a point. So now it's very, like I've worked on it as a skill and it's just there. So when I do it, and then I started looking at art. So I started mixing probably about 10 years ago, I started pulling up like Da Vinci paintings or Monet's or, you know, all these famous, you know, Renaissance artists, Van Gogh's, and trying to go, okay, like, let me look at the picture and mix and just try to copy those colors. And when I started doing that, the records started sounding like taking on a whole new life. And then I noticed that when I hand them in or send them to the artist, everybody, oh my God, this sounds amazing. They wouldn't know it. They wouldn't know it, but I could tell by the comments that when I was like nailing this and goes, yeah, that's pretty good. Or like, you know, I have these dark shades on my windows right now, but I would take them off and look at the yard and kind of mix into the yard. Like when I mixed Nita Strauss's record, who plays with Alice Cooper, it's an instrumental record. There's no vocals on it. I forget what the name of the record was called, her first instrumental. But basically all I did on the whole record and all the mixes was look outside and just mix the backyard and visualize the what my backyard looked like with all the trees and shrubs and flowers and placed everything musically like that and use that. So then I started telling somebody I was doing that and they go, oh, that sounds like you have, you know, that you see it's actually a condition. There's people that have it. And then I go, oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Synesthesia. Yeah.
Yeah. Anesthesia, whatever. Yeah.
We're going to see her tonight.
Yeah. So, and then I go, oh, well, maybe I do have that.
Well, Mike, that does bring us, you know, to the end of our time. You know, people listening, you can keep in touch with Mike at mikeplotnikoff.net. And of course, on social media, you know. So, Mike, thanks for thanks for being our guest today on the Rock Music Alliance interview sessions. Thanks, man.
Yeah, awesome.
We should get him back.
Instagram would be the best for if you want to stay in touch with me. Like, I don't really check my mikeplotnikoff.net. I'm not really on Facebook, but the really thing is Instagram. That's what I, you know. So, if anybody wants to go there, just go to Mike Plotnikoff on Instagram, and that would be the best place.
I'm Cole Coleman, and for Claudio Pesavento, the Rock Music Alliance, and the RMA Awards, thanks for watching and listening. Visit us at rockmusicalliance.com and check out this year's RMA Awards for rock, metal, and progressive rock music.